It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Anyone who took the walk that we took around this neighborhood would not think you're in a wealthy nation. You would think that you were in a third world country. What we're talking about is a community in which half of the people don't have jobs. We're talking about a community in which there are hundreds of buildings that are uninhabitable.
Well, that wasn't President Donald Trump. That was presidential candidate Bernie Sanders talking about Baltimore. And maybe during the show sometime, I'll get into all the information I have stacked here about Baltimore. Everyone's talking about the president's, talking about it being rat infested. And of course, the inference is that he's then talking about black people being infested. That's what they're trying to do, is make that transfer that this is racist and black people are infested. And of course, that's not what the president said. And it's not what Bernie Sanders said either. You know, infested, run down, horrible cities are not, they have nothing to do with race. They do have something to do with political party, it seems, because most of the ones we see, it's San Francisco, it's areas of Seattle, it's Portland, it's the inner city of Chicago, it's New York City under de Blasio. They are, you know, a Michigan under Democratic leadership. People that live in the inner cities many times happen to be black, Hispanic. I'm telling you, in some of these big cities, that there are a lot of people of all colors. Do we not know that? And so we are hearing more and more information about how really bad Baltimore is. We're learning more and more about it. I'll get to it. I just think everyone's talking about it so much. And honestly, I get impatient. It's like the dust up du jour, because it's silly to me. Baltimore is in big trouble. And you just have only to speak to people who live there. You have to go visit it and hope that you don't get mugged. The waterfront is beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. They restored it, but it's very unsafe. And people are being attacked, and it's filthy. And even the citizens, you know, when the president says no citizen would want to live there, well, yes, black or white don't want to live that way. People don't want to live that way. Are we assuming that it's okay with black people to live in rat-infested neighborhoods? If we think that's okay, then we're not racist? It's all so twisted. And so we'll come back to that. But honestly, I'm going to tell you something today that I think is more important than that. And that is the nomination of John Ratcliffe to be the head of Defense National Intelligence. And Rich Edson had a report on it last night on Fox. This is clip 4. Let's listen.
Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats is out. In his letter to President Trump, Coats writes, quote, "As we have previously discussed, I believe it is time for me to move on to the next chapter of my life." Coats says he's leaving August 15th, ending a tenure that included intelligence assessments, sometimes at odds with President Trump's, and surprise after learning the president invited Vladimir Putin to Washington.
Vladimir Putin coming to
the... Did I hear you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Coates thoroughly defended the intelligence community's assessment. Russia interfered in the 2016 election to help the Trump campaign. Testified North Korea was unlikely to dismantle its weapons and joined other intelligence officials testifying they believed Iran was not developing a nuclear weapon. President Trump called those intelligence officials passive and naive and suggested they should go back to school. The president announced he would nominate Texas Republican Congressman and former federal prosecutor John Ratcliffe days after his aggressive questioning and condemnation of special counsel Robert Mueller.
Can you give me an example other than Donald Trump where the Justice Department determined that an investigated person was not exonerated because their innocence was not conclusively determined?
I cannot, but this is a unique situation.
Okay, well, I'll tell you why. It doesn't exist.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer charges Ratcliffe's blind loyalty secured him the nomination. And, quote, if Senate Republicans elevate such a partisan player to a position requiring intelligence expertise and nonpartisanship, it'd be a big mistake. Senator Ron Wyden adds, quote, Congressman Ratcliffe is the most partisan and least qualified individual ever nominated to serve as Director of National Intelligence. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo points out he made a similar transition from Congress to the intelligence community.
He's very smart. I'm very confident he'll do a good job. I remember people saying I'd be too political to be the CIA director, too.
All right. So that was Rich Edson's report last night. And I wanted you to hear it because this is really important in what's happening right now. Time magazine has an article, and let me just read the headline. Top GOP senator warned the White House about Trump's choice for national intelligence director. And this is how it reads. President Donald Trump's decision to name a staunch Republican ally with a limited background in spycraft to replace Dan Coats as the nation's top intelligence official has aroused concern on Capitol Hill, including a warning to the White House from the Republican head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. But among veteran members of the nation's intelligence agencies, the mood is resignation. In naming Texas Republican Representative John Ratcliffe to be Director of National Intelligence, Trump ignored a warning from Republican Senator Richard Burr, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Burr told the White House last week that the move would inject more partisan politics into the work of the intelligence agencies, said the sources who requested anonymity because they were not authorized to speak on the matter. All right, a couple of things I want to say. When I hear that Richard Burr is against John Ratcliffe, my heart leaps for joy because to me it's a very good sign. Richard Burr and his intelligence committee is the most corrupt committee in the Senate. Do you remember that the chief of staff was arrested because he was passing on the nation's top secrets to a Washington Post reporter who he was having an affair with, plus a whole lot more, and he got away with a very light sentence. Oh, and it goes on to talk about how the Intelligence Committee, let me read more. The former Republican senator from Indiana, now this is Dan Coats, who's currently serving till the 15th of August, says the Senate Intelligence Committee's ranking Democrat, the former Republican senator from Indiana and longtime ally of Vice President Mike Pence kept politics out of the agency's work, says Senate Intelligence Committee's ranking Democrat Mark Warner. Unlike Mark Warner, who walks and talks partisan politics. So if Mark is praising Dan Coats, then that's a problem, folks. And he goes on to say, the mission of the intelligence agencies is to speak truth to power. At DNI, Dan Coats stayed true to that mission. I want to jump to another article here, and this is one by the Daily Caller, whose headline is, Media Outlets Rush Out Democratic Talking Points After Trump Nominates New Director of National Intelligence. So Democrat officials began using the phrase, speak truth to power, to applaud DNI, Director of National Intelligence. I'm going to use those letters to make it easier, DNI. Dan Coats, while insinuating that incoming DNI, John Ratcliffe, may not uphold this standard. Multiple media outlets parroted this phrase, including in its articles. It applauds Coats and quoted those who have reservations regarding Ratcliffe. Speak truth to power is one of the standards of the Intelligence Committee, according to its website. And so that's what they're using. And they go through and they track. They talk about the Washington Post, the New York Times, and these pundits and how they keep repeating that same phrase, and Democratic candidates. And so you're going to hear that. You're already hearing that. So what's behind all of this? Let me just say, there's one way to figure this out. There is an interesting back and forth play between, it's a montage that Fox had on last night, Dan Coats and President Trump contradicting each other on issues. Let's listen to clip 10.
Our mission was to seek the truth and speak the truth.
Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia.
They are the ones that are trying to wreak havoc over our election process. We need to call them out on that.
They're short-range missiles, and my relationship is very good with Chairman Kim, and we'll see what happens.
North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities and is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons.
Are you considering or planning to
replacing Dan Coats as your Director of National Intelligence?
I haven't even thought about it.
The time of the gentleman from Indiana has expired.
All right, so I said yesterday, and I'll say again, when Dan got elected in Indiana, I think many of us thought he was a good, solid conservative. And through the years, I became more and more disappointed with him. So I'm just telling you that up front. And here are some concrete reasons why. When he was appointed, and I know that he was appointed because remember Reince Priebus and Vice President Pence, well-connected with the mainstream leadership of the Republican Party, with the people that actually want to purge conservatives on social issues. I don't know how Mike Pence became aligned with him, but he has. And Dan Coats certainly gravitated toward the power base in Washington. And to example that, when you will recall, we heard over and over again that 18 intelligence agencies had verified that the Russians were trying to help Hillary Clinton get elected. And the president was saying, not so fast, not so fast. And now we know that that's not true. We know, if anything, that the Russians supplied the information on that phony dossier. The dossier was paid for by Hillary Clinton's camp. It was the dossier that started the FBI investigation, well, at least in part. And we know that the Russians very much interfered through the Democrats to try to help Hillary Clinton. That we do know. Remember that Mueller's investigation found no collusion with the Russian camp, with the Trump camp, with the Russians. Anyway, and while this is all happening, Dan Coats is out defending the intelligence community against the president. He did that repeatedly. And he said emphatically that the Russians interfered to help Donald Trump defeat Hillary Clinton. And then I want to replay something that Rich played in his clip. Dan Coats was out at, there's some meetings out west. Andrea Mitchell and Dan Coats. And this is very short. But remember that Dan Coats is serving at the behest of President Trump. He is his Defense National Intelligence head. And he's talking with Andrea Mitchell, who hates President Trump, is a leftist, is a leftist. That's all I can say. And they're on the stage, and this director of national intelligence is being interviewed by Andrea, and this is the exchange. Let's listen, clip five.
Vladimir Putin coming
to
the...
Did I hear you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
What you didn't hear, the first part where she says, I understand the president's going to meet with Vladimir Putin. I wanted you to listen to it again, clip five.
Vladimir Putin coming
to the... Did I hear you?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be special.
Yeah, so that's the director of national intelligence under President Trump undermining him publicly, laughing, mocking at him. Now, there's nothing wrong with President Trump talking to Vladimir Putin, so that he just totally bought in, I think, to the left. And if you need further proof, let me read this to you. Guess who's against John Ratcliffe? Oh my goodness, I want to play that John Ratcliffe. I want to tell you why they're so against John Ratcliffe. We have to get that one in clip six.
What we need to do is make sure we don't do what the Democrats have done. They accuse Donald Trump of a crime, and then they try and reverse engineer a process to justify that accusation. So I'm not going to accuse any specific person of any specific crime. I just want there to be a fair process to get there. What I do know as a former federal prosecutor is it does appear that there were crimes committed during the Obama administration. You talked earlier about Michael Flynn. His phone call with the Russian ambassador was a highly classified NSA intercept. Someone in the Obama administration leaked that call to the Washington Post. That's a felony. Glenn Simpson from Fusion GPS, in talking about the Steele dossier, said under oath that he and Bruce Orr did not meet until after the election. Bruce Orr said under oath that they met 3 months before the election. One of them is not telling the truth. We need a process to identify that. Where it all started, Jim Comey, he admitted that he leaked his confidential conversations with the president to a reporter. Did that include classified information? We need a fair process to find out answers to that.
All right, I'm going to interrupt John Ratcliffe. That is why. That is why James Comey publicly and John Brennan publicly and Rod Rosenstein publicly are decrying the appointment of James Ratcliffe. It's just really interesting. We'll see what happens.
The Ministry of Preborn meets abortion-minded women right where they are. When a young mom sees her baby on ultrasound, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby.
And I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
This mom chose life for her baby.
She's been such a joy. Her name even means rebirth and sort of being raised up from the ashes. I now see my daughter, and I cannot imagine my life without my happy, lovely, joyful, smart baby, and I'm so grateful.
Preborn runs and leads Christian pregnancy centers all over the country. To find out more, go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say baby. Your love can save a life.
This is Pause to Pray, a moment each day to pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Henry Childs II, the National Director of the Minority Business Development Agency. His agency is dedicated to the growth and global competitiveness of U.S. minority-owned businesses. Luke 6:38 reminds us of the importance of helping lift up others. Give, and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask you to guide Henry Childs II as he works on behalf of minority-owned businesses in the U.S. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Fox News Commentary with Todd Starnes.
Hello, Americans. Understanding the Great Divide. That story next.
Truett McConnell University.
So my name is Atara. I'm a senior and my major is psychology. I love Truett. Maybe a lot of other schools out there. You can go to bigger schools. You can go to schools that's way far away from home. But in the end, one of the things that I realize is that God called me here, and that's why Truett is the perfect place for me. And if God called you here, then it's the perfect place for you also.
Are you called? Visit Truett.edu today.
Former Clinton staffer Joe Lockhart dropped a bombshell on Twitter the other day. He said that anyone who votes for President Trump in 2020 is a racist. That seems to be the new narrative embraced by Democrats and the mainstream media. President Trump weathered the Stormy Daniels controversy, and he was exonerated in the Mueller report. They tried to smear him as a traitor, but that failed too. So now the left wants you to believe the president and his followers are racist. I suspect in the long term their efforts will be futile, but the smear campaign is already having an immediate impact. The discourse has become more coarsened, and the racial divide has grown wider, and the blame rests solely on the Democrats. Good and decent people, black and white and brown, must stand up, and we must preserve the nation. I'm Todd Starnes.
That's your Fox News commentary.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We can balance the budget very quickly.
But do you think in 5 years?
I think over a five-year period, and I don't know, maybe I could even surprise you.
We are not paying for the government that we are getting. And unless we're going to continue to steal money from our kids, we have to make a very difficult choice, which is, are we going to raise taxes or are we going to reduce spending?
All right, so you heard in order there, presidential candidate Donald Trump and then Mick Mulvaney, who is now his budget director. And in the face of what they said, we are launching into incredibly greater debt than we have ever seen. We've been saying that for years now. Under President Obama, even under George W. Bush, the debt began to grow. And now we're at $22 trillion. And just last week, the House, as we discussed yesterday, passed a bill. The House, at least so far, has passed this bill that would increase our deficits by, some are projecting, another $2 trillion. And it would pile $322 billion on the spending that we already have. And rather than me waxing eloquent on that, I want to invite Rachel Bovard to come with us because she is the Senior Director of Policy for Conservative Policy. Sorry, Rachel. Allergies. For Conservative Partnership in Washington. And so, Rachel, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So in your own words, Rachel, tell us how bad this bill really is.
Well, it's difficult to really be hyperbolic about it because it is so bad. This deal really dismantles. If you're a fiscal conservative, you recall the Budget Control Act, which was the biggest fiscal conservative gains in a decade, passed in 2011 under the leadership of my current boss, former Senator Jim DeMint, and a host of others, put in place the first reduction in discretionary spending since the Eisenhower administration by enforcing spending caps. This deal undoes those spending caps. So the Budget Control Act and the gains from it are officially dead. But on top of that, it suspends the debt ceiling for two straight years and does not limit the amount of money that the Congress can spend. So that is really significant. There are no controls here for how much the government can spend. And with House Democrats really in charge here, we are going to look at skyrocketing deficits. And when you put this in the context of the fact that the U.S., our debt-to-GDP ratio is 105% in the first quarter of 2019. The World Bank says that economies start to slow their growth when the GDP ratio, debt-to-GDP ratio, is 77%. We have really blown past that point, so our economy is now being affected by how much we're spending.
So I think people, normal people, ask the question, Rachel, why would Steve Mnuchin, who is the president's, I can't think of his title, but he's the one who negotiated with Nancy Pelosi, not Mick Mulvaney, who was a deficit hawk. So what was he negotiating for? I mean, what is the gain from the White House's perspective in this horrible budget?
Well, it's interesting, you know, to watch this over time. The White House has really been working on this for the last 5 months. They've been involved in these negotiations. And, you know, in speaking with some Trump administration officials, they walked in knowing they weren't going to get everything they wanted because the House Democrats are, you know, in charge of the House. But what they really were hoping for were Senate Republicans to back their negotiating strategy and to, you know, come to the table and back the White House. And you saw initially Mick Mulvaney, who's at the Chief of Staff, and Russ Vogt at OMB come out and say, look, we want a straight, clean spending freeze. We don't want to increase, we don't want to decrease. Senate Republicans laughed them out of the room. Senate Republicans were actively negotiating with House Democrats more than they were with their own president. And you saw everything sort of result in the fact that the White House got painted into a corner over what Senate Republicans and House Democrats agreed to without them. And you saw the White House come out with this last ditch effort to say, look, why don't you at least try to put in these offsets? Let's pay for the amount of spending we're going to do. Here's $150 billion worth of suggestions. Senate Republicans flat out ignored them. They put in $77 billion worth of offsets, but they are the kind of offsets that are fake. They're scheduled to take place so far in the future that they'll never actually go into effect. And so the White House was really undermined by the Senate Republicans that would have been critical to getting any of the Trump demands in this bill. Mitch McConnell and his Republicans had no interest in working with the White House on that.
Yeah, Mitch actually, as according to news reports, I know you're very familiar with this, Senator McConnell actually told the president that no politician had ever lost because he spent more money. Didn't he basically say that?
Yeah, that was reported in the Washington Post with two sources. He said that to President Trump in the Oval Office, and I think that really shocked a lot of people because we can go back as recently as 2010 to the Tea Party wave to say, actually, no, people do pay attention to spending.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. And here was telling to me, Rachel, I saw Chuck Schumer's response to this budget. And I asked Adam to pull the clip, which I haven't heard, but I think it's the right one. And let's listen to his response to this budget. That should tell us something.
Now, yesterday, the four congressional leaders and the Trump administration, led by Secretary Mnuchin, reached a deal that provides certainty in Washington for the next 2 years. And I was glad to see that the president tweeted and the White House confirmed in a statement that he supports the agreement. The bipartisan budget agreement will strengthen our national security and clear the way for important investments in America's middle class, in veterans, in health care, in education, in child care, in cancer research, and more. I am pleased this deal achieves three important wins for Democrats. First, it moves defense spending and non-defense spending closer together. We had always been for 50-50. Every dollar increase in defense should be non-defense. We did somewhat better than that this time. And the increase on the non-defense side exceeds the increase on the defense side by $10 billion over the next 2 years. Second, the deal permanently ends the threat of sequester. It's gone. And all the suffering that occurred because of the sequester is gone as well. And it eliminates the threat of a default, maintaining the full faith and credit of the United States.
All right. So there's a Chuck Schumer, the Senate minority leader, ecstatic about this bill. Rachel, just your comments on his comments, please.
Yeah, I mean, you can hear the glee in his voice, right? They got a ton out of this deal. They, you know, Democrats had really key priorities, and they were to increase domestic spending, and that is exactly what they got. They got very little pushback from anyone on it. And when the White House tried to weigh in and push back, Senate Republicans said, yeah, get out of the room. You know, we don't care what you have to say. So, look, this is squarely at the feet of Senate Republicans who are going to pass this deal to likely this week before they leave for a month-long August recess. So I have to say, from a Senate Republican perspective, you know, fiscal conservatism is dead for all intents and purposes.
It just makes me sick, honestly, Rachel. It just makes me sick. It's just one of so many issues where Republican leadership and the majority of Republican senators are playing on a different team than the rest of us. They just are, and that's the kindest way I know how to put it. I want to ask you about the House, because I found it really interesting that 132 Republican members of the House voted against this bill. It was 65 Republicans who voted with the Democrats. And all of them, all the people that voted, the Republicans that voted with the Democrats, were House leadership. Kevin McCarthy, Steve Scalise, names are escaping me in the moment. But so I want to know, transferring to something a little different, I was shocked, really, that 132 Republican congressmen voted against the leadership on this. And I wondered if you think that if this is maybe in some way a silver lining, is there a crack in the trust and leadership in the House? Do you think this is kind of an example of that, or am I overreading into it?
Yeah, I think you have to give a lot of credit here to the House conservatives. I mean, you had Congressman Chip Roy, the new congressman from Texas, months ago reading a letter saying we need to hold to the budget caps. We need to preserve those spending caps that were passed as part of the Budget Control Act. He got 45 members to sign that, largely members of the House Freedom Caucus. You saw a couple of months later, the Republican Study Committee come out opposed to this legislation. That has 190-some members. You know, so you really saw the conservatives stand up and say, actually, this is not something we want to support. You do see a significant divergence here between the leadership, who seems to have no problem supporting, you know, these giant spending deals, and the conservatives, who make up a large portion of the conference now, of the Republican conference. So I'm sure these issues are going to continue to be discussed. And now there's, you know, members have gone on the record. It's just going to add a little bit of heat, I think, to the discussions between conservatives and their leadership.
Okay, so you've already mentioned that you think the Senate will vote this week. They're on recess right now, so how does that happen? Do they fly just to vote?
Well, the Senate is still here. The House is gone. The House recessed last week. They said, see ya, and they peaked out. But the Senate is still here. They have one more week of session, and that's this week. So I expect them to address the spending bill probably tomorrow or Thursday before they jet out for their month-long break.
So do you expect anyone, I mean, I expect that Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and maybe Mike, I don't know, how are senators going to come down on this? Is this an overwhelming victory for the Republicans? Will they follow Mitch McConnell, or will they, you know, listen to the House Freedom Caucus?
Yeah, you know, I think the reliably conservative votes in the Senate will be opposed to it. Ted Cruz has already said he's going to vote against it. Rand Paul has said the same. I believe Mike Lee has as well. You know, you may see a couple of others, Pat Toomey, you know, some of the more fiscally conservative senators come out, but it's going to be a small number. I think a large majority of the Republican conference is going to vote, for this deal, and you're going to see nearly all Democrats support it. So it will largely pass with Democrat votes.
So is it, would it do any good for people to call their senators?
Of course. You know, that's a right that we have in this country. They should know exactly how you feel about it. You know, I think, you know, it's important for voters to combat this notion that Mitch McConnell told the president that voters don't care about spending. That is essentially what he told President Trump. A politician has never lost for spending more money. I would say that's empirically wrong, but, you know, that's an attitude that if people are fiscally conservative, you don't want your senator or your congressman to think that. You want them to know that you care. Like, you care when your government spends billions and trillions of dollars without regard to the consequence.
Yeah, it is pretty scary. I mean, no spending caps. In other words, they can spend anything they want for the next 2 years without any kind of restriction. And our debt is so incredible. And I think, Rachel, well, I don't know, I'm not a mathematician, but the projection is $2 trillion more dollars in the next, till 2022, something like that. And you can imagine if the Democrats are in charge of the House, which is the spending, the body that controls spending, that spending is going to go to the moon and back. And so let me just say that Rachel has a book. She will write a book on this, but she has an article
I do have a book coming out in September.
Oh, you do? All right. Well, when it gets closer to September, we'll promote your book, Rachel. This article is Fiscal Conservatism, Rest in Peace. And we'll put that on our Facebook page because I think it will be good for all of you to have some tool. And then when you call your senator, you can actually figure out kind of the words you'll have, know what you're talking about. I guess the bottom line is, of course we care about spending. How dare you? I think I just say that. How dare you? Do not vote for this spending bill. And remember, 2020 is coming. You know, a lot of them are up for re-election. A lot of Republicans are up for re-election, Rachel. What are they thinking?
You know, they really genuinely seem to think that people aren't paying attention to this. And in fairness, Robert Mueller's testimony was dominating the headlines last week when this bill passed the House. But there's a few more people, I hope, paying attention, when it passes the Senate this week. But I think you've got to remember how high the stakes are. This will be the first time in 10 years that there is no budgetary restrictions on spending in Washington. That is not insignificant and a fact that needs to be underscored when you're talking about this issue.
Okay, so let me. We just have a few minutes left here. All indicators are that the president will sign this, and yet I'm hearing in other meetings that possibly, with the right outcry from people, he might not sign it. What are your thoughts about that, Rachel?
You know, Trump is not always predictable in these situations. You know, he said he supports this legislation. You know, I think he's not in the mood for a government shutdown. But then again, I do think it's important that he also hear from fiscal conservatives. He said he wasn't going to sign a bill like this again. And I think Senate Republicans put him in a bad position. And I think that the more he hears from people who oppose it, the more he's going to understand how his White House got painted into a corner. And hopefully he'll be loath to have it happen again.
All right, so there's a double assignment. It's calling the White House and calling your senator and telling them not to vote for this budget, this horrible budget that will allow Congress to just go crazy with spending. This will not end well for any of us. Rachel, but the other side of that, if the president should veto it, then where does that leave him? I understand that there is another alternative. What might that be?
Well, it puts them back to the drawing board. I mean, there's no real hard deadline here. The one concrete deadline is the debt ceiling, which has to be dealt with in the next several months. But there's measures the Treasury Department can take to sort of push that down, you know, push that out a little bit. So that they'd have to go back to the drawing board, and Congress would have to come back from its vacation to actually deal with this problem. So there's people, I think, that would argue that would be a good outcome. But, you know, that's probably, you know, less of a chance, I think, than the president actually signing it.
Okay, well, it is our government still. It's of the people, by the people, for the people. It's not for the leaders of the Senate. It's not even for the president. If he is not concerned about debt, he needs to be, and we need to remind him. Rachel's article is Fiscal Conservatism, Rest in Peace. Put it on our Facebook page so that you can read it and access it. There's a ton more we could say about this, and we will as the week progresses. Rachel Bovard of Conservative Partnership. Rachel, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. All right, well, coming up next, we probably will touch on Baltimore, but there's a lot of other interesting news, too. So I may not. I just may not. I don't know. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savor, how will it be seasoned? My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Matt Walsh wrote a piece for the Daily Wire where he said, "The contemporary American Christian is the most open-minded person to have ever existed. He's so open-minded, you can hardly tell he's Christian or has a mind at all. He has for a long time been open to the idea that marriage isn't permanent and sex isn't meant exclusively for marriage. He's basically open to whatever notions are popular. He is open, and where he is not open, he is silent."
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
As a 10-year-old boy, my dad and our whole family started back to church.
Bert Harper on the Word of God.
And the church I went to, the pastor really preached the Word of God with conviction. I knew that it was a book that we could depend upon and live our lives by. And I hope I bring that same passion into exploring the Word.
Exploring the Word with Bert Harper and Alex McFarland. Weekday afternoons at 3 Central on American Family Radio.
Why engaging our kids is so important. Mm. Why it's so important that we don't make them feel like they are a burden, like we just can't wait until they're out of the way. Like, the proven fact is that if we disregard our children as they are growing, we are really risking their adherence to the faith as adults.
Airing the Addisons, weekday afternoons at 2 Central on American Family Radio.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. One of the unfortunate casualties of our digital culture is the death of the family meal. Dads, you need to take the lead in seeing to it that your family has dinner together as often as possible. It's good for you, and it's good for your kids. A study from New Zealand shows that junior high students who enjoy frequent family meals have higher levels of emotional well-being and lower levels of depression. In Iran, believe it or not, adolescents who have regular family meals are less likely to suffer from anxiety, insomnia, and all types of mental disorders. Family meals are linked to lower levels of suicide and higher levels of self-esteem among adolescents and among adults who shared family meals when they were adolescents. Hey, if it works in Iran, it'll work here. Bon appetit.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, the world had a close encounter with a city-killer asteroid. It surprised the world's astronomers, and therefore, with scarcely any warning, this monster rock half a mile wide hurtled by at just a fifth of the distance to the moon. Had this asteroid hit the Earth, the impact would have been 30 times the explosive force of the atomic bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. While such an event wouldn't have ended life as we know it, another space phenomenon, an intense solar storm, could have that effect. The electromagnetic energy thus unleashed would damage or destroy electric grids around the world, and we are overdue for such a catastrophe. Such naturally occurring events and our terrestrial enemies' interest in using space against us underscore the urgent need for a space force led by an individual capable of developing responses to these challenges. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Well, the Democratic debates begin tonight, I think at 8 o'clock on NBC. I'm sure there'll be on other networks and cable shows, because somehow these things get covered very broadly. Okay, so the interesting thing is that there's a kind of the level that a candidate has to have a support in order to appear in the main debates is 2%. So at this point, the people that are at 2% or higher are Biden, Warren, Sanders, Harris, Buttigieg, Yang, and Beto O'Rourke. So if they stay at 2% or higher, they will be in that September debate. So 13 candidates are below. That's Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Tulsi Gabbard, Julian Castro, Bill de Blasio, Christian Gillibrand, John Delaney, Marianne Williamson, Steve Bullock, John Hickenlooper, Tim Ryan, Michael Bennett, and Jay Inslee. And so they are now below, unless they do something happens, and somebody drops out and they get above 2%. It will be Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, Beto, and Beto O'Rourke. Now, tonight, my understanding is that it will be Bernie Sanders and Beto O'Rourke and Elizabeth Warren. Those will be the kind of the big guns on the stage. I just thought it was funny because, I'm sorry, this struck me. Beto O'Rourke, the fake Mexican, will be debating Elizabeth Warren, the fake Cherokee Indian. I think that's pretty interesting. I just thought I would make that observation. Yes, I have a bias. I do. I just can't. I have trouble taking them seriously, except we have to because they could win. And so many of the American people, because they are so uninformed, I think we really found out last week with the Mueller hearings how we do have, as who said this? It was a presidential candidate, John Edwards, said that there were two Americas. Remember that? And it really is true in this sense that there are two Americas when it comes to information. There's a vast swath of Americans who know nothing except the sound bites they hear from CNN or MSNBC or the mainstream media. They don't know anything else. They don't know about all the things that you know about that came out in the Mueller hearings through the Republicans asking questions on the committee. And remember the CNN anchor yesterday that we played, he actually admitted, he said, the Republicans brought up things we never discuss on this network. So when your neighbors and friends don't know, they just don't know. They just don't know. And so they think that Bernie Sanders and Beto O'Rourke and, Kamala Harris and all the rest of them, they're the champions. That's what they think because they have such bad information. And so that kind of takes us to this next thing. Well, that this whole thing about Baltimore is, I've already told you how I feel about it, and yet we'll talk about it because I want to make sure I add some things to your information that you might not hear. Griff Jenkins reported on it this morning on Fox. And friends, let's listen to that first.
If you thought the president was backing down from this fight, well, think again. The president has continued to escalate his feud with the Baltimore lawmaker with more tweets like this one yesterday. Baltimore's numbers are the worst in the United States on crime and the economy. Billions of dollars have been pumped in over the years, but to no avail, the money was stolen or wasted. Ask Elijah Cummings where it went. He should investigate himself with his oversight committee. The president was also tweeting yesterday about Reverend Al Sharpton, calling him a con man and a troublemaker. He tweeted ahead of a press conference Sharpton held in Baltimore, joined by former RNC Chairman Michael Steele, where Sharpton called the president a racist and added this.
He has a particular venom for blacks and people of color. He doesn't refer to any of his other opponents or critics as infested.
Speaking of infested, a rat actually ran across the screen during a local reporter's hit about the very subject they were talking about.
Yeah, so that was at least the first part of Griff's report. And Doug McElway actually, so much to say. Doug McElway actually did a report, a really good one on Baltimore last night. But before I do that, let me just go back and trace this. Elijah Cummings has been, I think even Griff, when they report this, it's like when you're in a reporter in D.C. or in that bubble, everything becomes political and everything kind of becomes amusing. When there are real human elements to these stories, in this case, President Trump's family is being harassed by Elijah Cummings, the chairman of the Oversight Committee. And you recall that after the Democrats won the House, they started sending out like dozens and dozens and dozens, probably hundreds, of subpoenas for information from financial records and records of other things by anyone associated with the Trump campaign, including his family. So right now, I know that Elijah Cummings is really putting Ivanka Trump to the paces. And as we played yesterday, that interaction with Chip Roy, she is trying to comply with this, but they've asked for so much. And so they're making more and more demands. And at the same time, Elijah Cummings was in a hearing with the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kevin McElhaney, and Elijah Cummings basically said, how dare you allow those children down there to be sitting in their own feces and their own urine, and they can't, you know, just berating him and berating the border agents. And that's what set the president off, one of the many things. So the president went after Elijah Cummings, and he basically said, you know, how can he talk about that when his own city, his own district, is really in such disarray? It's infested with rats. And of course, the leftists have taken that to say that President Trump is saying that black people are infested, which is not what he said. And now I just look, I have enough, I'm not saying, I black friends to know that I don't know why there's a different class of thinking, like we think they can't figure this out. Black Americans are just like white Americans. They are people with reasoning and minds. We are human beings created by God in the same way, with except for our skin color. And I just don't believe that black Americans really, unless it's like a swath of uninformed, dumb white Americans who don't understand that they're being manipulated with this word infested. But many, the ones that are paying attention are just like us. They know this is ridiculous. So here's the story. And so Al Sharpton comes out and he starts taking on the president. Now, he and the president have been friends of a sort for years. So the racist President Trump has been, you know, a friend to Al Sharpton. And he basically tweeted, I've known Al for 25 years, went to fights with him, and Don King always got along well. He loved Trump. He would ask me for favors often. Al is a con man, a troublemaker, always looking for a score, just doing his thing. Must have intimidated Comcast and NBC. He hates whites and cops. And it's interesting, Breitbart did a fact check on Al Sharpton. I want to go back on that just for a second. We'll put this on our Facebook page. Al Sharpton's History of Racism, Anti-Semitism, and Anti-Police Rhetoric. And that's one of the things that the president pointed out, is that Al is anti-police. And so he's taking these guys on, these guys who've been race baiters for decades. And I know that, listen, I can just tell you, I want to say this again because it's important. I don't care how cliche it is. My black activist friends in Chicago were not fooled by Jesse Jackson or the Al Sharptons. They took them on. And so I think most reasonable black Americans understand that they have been manipulated. Many black Americans have been manipulated by these guys. Now the president's calling them out. And so I want to just give you an idea of what Al Sharpton has done, just to remind you. And some of you are younger and you wouldn't know. In 1987, Sharpton backed a teenager named Tawana Brawley. Tawana accused someone of being raped. She said she was raped. And Al Sharpton jumped in and stirred racial division in New York and across the country, created so many problems. And then we found out that it was a complete lie. And he knew that. And yet he stirred that up in 1987. In 1991, he helped incite riots against religious Jews in Crown Heights in Brooklyn after a black child was killed in a car accident. And so, you know, he stirred it up and made it racial. An enraged mob murdered a visiting Jewish religious student, Yankel Rosenbaum. And so Rosenbaum said, I've never seen a person be able to avoid being held accountable in substantive terms for his various and significant, serious, otherwise well-publicized misdeeds over such a prolonged period of time as Sharpton. This is truly an indictment of all those who have done so in the past and continue to do so. In another riot in 1995, Sharpton led protests against Freddie's Fashion Mart, which was a Jewish-owned store in Harlem, after it was forced to raise the rent on a subtenant, which was a black-owned record store. And he called the owner a white interloper. In 2008, his organization had massive debts, owed $2 million in taxes, which he refused to pay. In 2012, Sharpton and his organization played a key role in inflaming national division and outrage over the death of Trayvon Martin, accusing Zimmerman of calling out racial language, which was completely false. Zimmerman was, they called him a white Hispanic. Remember that? Zimmerman was, I don't know if he was Puerto Rican, Cuban, I can't recall. But it completely making that racial when it was not. And I could go on and on. We'll put that article on our Facebook page so you can see what Al Sharpton has been doing. But back to Baltimore. Doug McElway did a great report last night on, really, many people are now, but Doug did a especially good one on Fox last night that I want you to hear, about the conditions in Baltimore. Let's listen to clip two.
Amidst the Baltimore riots in the spring of 2015, Congressman Elijah Cummings took to the streets urging calm. More than 4 years later, the epicenter of the rioting remains as it was during that time. Boarded up buildings, vacant lots, homeless and jobless roaming about. For many, the president's incendiary tweet has all been heard before.
Mr. President, your reprehensible comments are like water off a duck's back when it comes to this community. It just washes over them.
Outside the Twitterverse and the Washington echo chamber, many people here had not even heard of the controversy. Lauren Baylor is one of the few who did.
But just because the neighborhood rat infested, that has nothing to do with the people and their personality, their beliefs, and their upbringing.
The 7th District is not just burned out buildings. It encompasses the revitalized Inner Harbor, once hailed as the model for post-industrial waterfront development around the world. It also includes Johns Hopkins University and Hospital, one of the finest in the world. It is home to above-average college education rates and home prices and a mix of urban and suburban areas. All of that left out of the president's tweets. One resident questioned the president's perspective.
He's a rich white man, like, so I don't even... It is what it is at that point. And he never been down here in the community to see how cultural and beautiful it is here.
So far this year, Baltimore has seen 180 homicides, on pace to exceed 300 for the fifth year in a row, the worst murder rate among any of America's largest cities. The transition from safe to insecure is often just a question of a few feet. Next to Johns Hopkins lies Douglas Holmes, where the Reverend Ann Chambers heads the Residential Advisory Board.
You know what,
she
I'm
has
gonna
seen
skip
many
this
changes
part.
To this once
you know,
vibrant
I'm
going to
skip
factory.
That because I want us to get to the next part of Doug's report. I'm running out of time here. Because this is important. This is clip three. Same Doug completing his report. Let's listen.
As for the president's comment that the city is rat infested, well, it is. According to Orkin's 50 rattiest cities, Baltimore comes in at number 9, well behind Washington, D.C. at number 4. The president's hometown of New York City ranks number 3, Chicago, the nation's rattiest city.
All right. So the president, that's what they're, you know, they're... It's just really ridiculous, but I'm going to keep going here. Mayor Pugh of Baltimore did a kind of a walk around in the city in September of 2018, and this is what she said. You can hear in part, except for the bleep parts, clip 7.
About a year ago, city leaders identified some of the city's most violent neighborhoods.
We should just take all this down.
To target.
Ooh, you can smell the rats.
Under Baltimore's Violence Reduction Initiative.
Ooh, Jesus.
Just last week, we went with Mayor Pugh as she toured an East Baltimore neighborhood.
This is a new one. I've been out here 54 years. This is a new one.
Baltimore's Violence Reduction Initiative is about taking steps to rid communities of the cornerstones that contribute to crime.
Oh, my God. You can smell the dead animals.
Blocks of dilapidated buildings help to hide the addiction that's crippled this community.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt that too, but you get the point. She said, oh, you can smell the rats. Oh, you can smell the dead animals. And yet the president talks about that, and he's a racist. Has nothing to do with race. You know, rats like all kinds of people. And when you don't clean and you don't keep things neat and you leave food out, you get rat infestation. When a city's not cared for, the rats come. In fact, there was a documentary made about the rats in Baltimore 2 years ago. And you might also find it interesting that Baltimore received $1.8 billion of Barack Obama's 2009 stimulus. Where did that money go? Where did that money go? I think the president's asking Elijah Cummings if he could find that out. And what's happening to all the money going to Baltimore? Why is his district so infested? And why is he so concerned about... Not concerned, but why is he blaming, actually mischaracterizing what's happening at the border and ignoring his own people in Baltimore? Why is he doing that? Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.